red ribbon of highway. I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me the golden valley. I said this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is mine. Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled and followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of our diamond deserts. And all around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there, it tried to stop me, and the sign was painted. Said private property, but on the backside it didn't say nothing. This sign was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Made for you and me. When the sun came shining and I was strolling in the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling and the voice was a chanting as the fog was lifting, and it said this land was made for you and me. This land is sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people as they stood hungry. I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up first, healthcare for some. Beatrix Hoffman explains why the United States has been one of the few developed countries not to adopt universal healthcare and examines why the issue is so divisive. And then after that, alternate economics. Manuel Castells says that the causes of the current financial crisis are so deep-rooted that they have given rise to a new economics.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gail Davis, Provost and Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs here, and a former faculty member of Women's Studies, Women's History, and so on. So I am doubly delighted to be here and happy that we're sponsoring this program. Thank you to all of you, and thank you, Gretchen, for the nice introduction. It's really going to be the best of all pleasures to introduce Dr. Beatrix Hoffman to you. She is a leading historian of U.S. healthcare systems. I bet you have been very busy during this political season, Beatrice. with the debate about what's best in healthcare, what's best in healthcare insurance, what's best for women's healthcare rights being in the air everywhere you look these days. So as a person addicted both to politics and an academic in women's history, I and I'm sure all of us are really looking forward to the presentation. So thanks for being here. You couldn't be in a better town for this talk either, since much of Grand Rapids, including Grand Valley State, has been very highly invested in the healthcare industry, hoping to develop stellar health education, research, innovation in practice, all in the quest for great healthcare here. I hope some of the visitors to town will be able to see what we call Health Hill on Michigan, where so much of the investment in medical health-related work has been made. Dr. Hoffman is professor and chair of the Department of History at Northern Illinois in DeKalb, Illinois. She completed her PhD, as it seems everyone at my table did, at Rutgers University in 1996. She's written extensively on the history of American healthcare reform, including a 2001 book entitled The Wages of Sickness, The Politics of Health Insurance in Progressive America that the University of North Carolina Press put out. In her talk today, though, she's going to speak about her latest book. That book's title is Healthcare for Some. Aha, I have a feeling it's going to be applicable to our times. The talk is entitled Healthcare for All, Women, Activism, and the Human Rights to Health. This is a history, her book, rather, and her talk today will be partly the history of rights and rationing in the United States from the Great Depression to the present. And the book just came out this month by the University of Chicago Press. I've seen copies of it flying around, so I wish I had one to hold up here. By all accounts, Dr. Hoffman has simply nailed this big historical topic up to the present moment. I'm going to read a few blurbs from the early reviews of the book just to give you a sense of how that is being received. T.R. Reid, who's author of The Healing of America, writes this: in the American political debate, everybody condemns the notion of rationing healthcare. But Beatrice Hoffman's meticulous history shows that rationing by income, age, employment, etc., has been and remains a central element of America's medical system. She demonstrates that our various attempts at reform over the decades have kept the rationing mechanisms firmly in place. So I wonder, do you think she'll talk about death panels too? I don't know. But Jonathan Oberlander, who's author of The Political Life of Medicare, writes this. Excuse me, my allergies are showing up this morning. Beatrice Hoffman skillfully chronicles America's struggles to make healthcare a right from the Depression through Obamacare. Hoffman's beautifully written account explores the pervasive rationing of medical care and insurance in our staggeringly unequal health system. Healthcare for Some is a compelling reminder of how far we've come, but also how far reform still has to go in the United States. The reviews keep this tone throughout. Beautifully written, insightfully described, and thoroughly researched, this book is a must read, sounds like to me. Thank you so much for your work. I know we are all in for a treat right now, so let me get out of the way and join me, please, in welcoming Dr. Hoffman to the stage.
Thank you so much for that really kind introduction. I'm honored. And again, I want to thank the conference organizers for inviting me to be here today. In July of 1938, the Roosevelt administration organized a national conference on health care reform. The Great Depression had been going on for nearly a decade. FDR had signed the Social Security Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act into law, but the United States still had no national program for addressing the health needs of the people. The 1938 health conference was the beginning of something different. Instead of inviting only doctors to speak, the conference for the first time included members of labor unions, farm groups, and civil rights organizations. It included representatives not just of the medical profession, but of the people who needed and used healthcare. That summer, a woman named Florence Greenberg traveled from Chicago, Illinois, to Washington to offer her testimony. Greenberg was a member of the Women's Auxiliary of the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, spending her days working in the communities around Chicago's steel mills. Greenberg told the audience at the National Health Conference that she had come to offer them a different picture of Chicago. Just steps away from the comfortable headquarters of the American Medical Association was a Chicago of dirt, filth, and tenements. A sick Chicago, where people struggled with terrible health conditions related to poverty and unemployment, and struggled to obtain basic medical care. Greenberg told the conference of the grossly overcrowded Cook County Hospital, the city's only public hospital, which locals described as a death house. A single overcrowded private hospital served the entire African-American community of the South Side. Chicago's outpatient clinics were filled to bursting. Greenberg spoke of people who were too sick to leave their homes but couldn't get a doctor to visit them, or who couldn't afford the few pennies for transportation to a clinic. She told the audience about a child with double pneumonia who had died of an abscessed lung after being turned out of a hospital because the relief agency would no longer pay for her care. And on behalf of the working people of Chicago, Florence Greenberg made the following demand. We're asking our government to take health from the list of luxuries to be bought only with money and add it to the list containing the inalienable rights of every citizen. We don't know whether Franklin Roosevelt ever heard about Florence Greenberg's unprecedented call for health care as a right, because even though he had endorsed the conference, he chose that time to go on vacation. FDR was actually on a cruise. I guess we can't really blame him. It's probably a pretty well-deserved vacation. But 3 years earlier, FDR had refused to include medical coverage as part of the Social Security Act because he did not want to antagonize the American medical profession. He did send a message of support to the health conference, but not long afterward, the outbreak of World War II forced the president's attention elsewhere. 5 years later, on January the 11th, 1944, in his State of the Union address, Roosevelt spoke to the American people about the war, and especially about the kind of peace the Allies planned to establish after the defeat of fascism. He said that the one supreme objective for the future can be summed up in one word, security. And that means not only physical security, which provides safety from attacks by aggressors, it means also economic security and social security. The individual political rights upon which the United States had been built, Roosevelt argued, were necessary but not sufficient to guarantee true freedom and security. FDR then announced an economic bill of rights, which is sometimes called the Second Bill of Rights, that included the right to a job and a living wage, the right to housing, education, and security in old age, and a right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. So even though FDR missed hearing Florence Greenberg's speech, we hear echoes of it in his Second Bill of Rights. The idea of economic and social rights as essential supplements to political rights had started as far back as the French Revolution, but the idea of a right to medical care was something much more recent. Discussion of this kind of right became prominent in the 1930s and 40s, first of all because medical care itself was becoming more effective. It was starting to matter much more in everyone's lives. By the 40s, the public knew about medical miracles like vaccinations, penicillin, antiseptic surgery, treatments that could save lives and even extend life. And to withhold these miracles came to seem unjust.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org. Or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And medical care at this time was also starting to cost more than ever before. The average family could not afford to pay for a hospital stay or a major illness or the birth of a child just out of their wages. So medical care had become not just a matter of life and health, it was also becoming something that could cause serious financial hardship. And that is why medical care became a matter of economic security as well as health security. In the U.S., demands for medical care as a social right originated in the workers' movements represented by people like Florence Greenberg. They next came to national prominence in FDR's proposed Second Bill of Rights. And finally, they were adopted in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights after World War II, thanks in part to Eleanor Roosevelt, who helped draft the UN's declaration after her husband's death. Today, more than 70 countries recognize a right to health or health care in their constitutions. Virtually every industrialized nation has taken steps to implement these rights by establishing some type of universal health coverage for their citizens, with one major exception, Anybody know who? The United States of America. But it's not for lack of trying. After FDR's death, President Harry Truman announced a national health insurance program that would have made medical coverage for all part of the Social Security Act. But the physicians of the American Medical Association attacked Truman's plan as socialized medicine. That might also sound familiar. And in the early Cold War, the AMA won that battle, and Truman's proposal was defeated. Other presidents, including Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, tried to pass universal health care programs, but they failed due to entrenched and vigorous opposition from not just the medical profession, but also opposition from business and an increasingly powerful insurance industry. Healthcare reform in the U.S. was pronounced impossible. But then the impossible happened. And today we have the 2010 Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which everybody's calling it now. So does the passage of the Affordable Care Act mean that we now have a right to health care in the United States? The answer is not really. There are some important victories for rights in the law. The biggest one is the ban on insurance companies being able to exclude people from coverage because they have pre-existing health conditions. The Affordable Care Act will also expand access to health coverage by providing federal subsidies for people who can't afford insurance on their own. But even when the law is fully implemented, if the law is fully implemented, I guess I should say, there will still be a lot of people without health insurance, estimated to be up to 30 million remaining uninsured. And this estimate actually became higher than originally projected because of the Supreme Court decision last summer, which will allow states to opt out of expanding Medicaid. And although the Affordable Care Act creates some new rights, there is still no universal right to medical care in America, with one major exception, and that is the right to be seen in an emergency room, which is something we've been hearing a lot about recently. But a right to emergency care is not the same thing. It's not a substitute for a system that takes care of people's health and protects their economic security. So why? Why is this the case? What has made the United States an outlier nation when it comes to the right to health care? I've been studying this question for a very long time, even way back in the 90s. And I'm sorry to say, although all the historians here won't be surprised to hear this, there is no single answer. My book, Healthcare for Some, tries to provide a few of the answers by analyzing the history of this country's long tradition of unequal access to health care. For the next few minutes, I'm going to talk about some of the book's arguments, and then I'll give a couple more examples of women activists who have challenged the American system of unequal access in the tradition of Florence Greenberg. So the subtitle of this book is Rights and Rationing in the United States. I've already talked a bit about rights and how Americans don't really have them when it comes to health care. In political argument, you'll often hear that the U.S. may have a lot of problems with its health system, but at least we don't ration the way Europeans and Canadians do. You've heard this. You may have heard the argument that universal health care means a government bureaucrat will deny you life-saving treatments in order to save money for the system. We still hear some people insisting that reform will lead to death panels. And during the first presidential debate, Governor Romney warned of an unelected board that will deny treatments under Obamacare. Not only are these claims misleading at best, but they also imply that rationing or the denial of health care would be something new to our system, something extremely un-American. But I believe that the claim that the U.S. does not currently ration health care has been counterproductive, damaging, and inaccurate. And my book uses historical evidence to show that the U.S. has rationed health care and has done so for a long time, not in the way Europeans or Canadians do through things like official waiting lists or caps on national health expenditures. But this country has allocated and denied health care in a complex and unique way that I call the American way of rationing. So what is the American way of rationing, and how can history help us understand it? In classical economics, rationing simply means that goods and services are distributed by price. In other words, not everybody can afford everything they could possibly want or need. So supply and demand are controlled by people's ability to pay. Rationing by price or rationing by the market certainly goes a long way to describe the U.S. healthcare delivery system. The government may not officially deny you healthcare, but many Americans cannot get the care they need because they can't afford it. Thank you.
And now for something completely different.